Welcome to the show. The name.
Yo, what's up?
Yet to be determined, perhaps in a switch. But for now, it is a Southside Report. I'm Mario Scalise in Chicago. Jason Gage alongside with me as usual in California. What's up, Jason?
What's up, man? It's good to be back. It's good to have another show under our belts.
Yes. It was, I think, 34 days. 34 days since the last live stream. Because this is live. It's on this Ustream thing, which is probably the only way you're listening to us. If you listen to us live, or you might be listening to the recording. But for now, you're listening to us live. And we are going to slowly but surely kind of evolve the show into more Chicago sports. Obviously get into the Bears, who not doing so well. Eventually get into the Bulls, which they start up, I believe, October 9th, which is just this coming week. And maybe little Cubs, Blackhawks as we go along, but that's pretty much a long shot as of right now. That's something way down the road. For now, it is just the White Sox, and at least for at this very moment, it is the White Sox, and their season finally ended, and one goal, it was a disaster season, but one goal that maybe the Sox had was to avoid 90 losses, because that's a pretty big number. When you get 90 losses, that pretty much means you're one of the worst teams in baseball, and they couldn't do it. They lost 90. They went 72-90 for the season. First time since, I'd have to say, the 80s, maybe, what, 89, I believe, was the last time they lost 90 games. That's a pretty long streak to actually have an average team and then just kind of sputter like they did this season.
Yeah, it wasn't a pretty season. I mean, we can quickly recap, but we're really not going to. All of you guys are fans. You all follow the White Sox. You know what it really got them. The first half of the season, it was a combination of a horrific offense and an absolutely atrocious rotation. And in the second half of the season, the team had kind of given up. There were some injuries. And bottom line, it wasn't a very talented lineup. Whenever you trot a guy like Andy Gonzalez out there onto the field, you know, pretty much five times a week, you're going to be in trouble, and you know you're going to be in trouble. You had McDougal on the DL. You had Urstead Epicenic going down. It shouldn't be a shock that either of those guys were on the DL,
no.
But the White Sox were counting on at least one of the two to be healthy for most of the season, or a combination of the two to be healthy throughout the season. And it whatever happened, it didn't work out. The Sox had a horrible year, but Ken Williams seemed committed to the fact that this team, it was a fluke, it was an aberration that they did have such a bad year, and that he believes they're only a few moves away from being back to being a competitive team, a team that's going to contend in one of the strongest divisions in baseball, the AL Central, next year. And Mario, what I want to know is, do you even think that it's possible for them to do that? Are they going to be able to compete next year?
There's no doubt the season was a fluke, but when you lose 90 games, how much of a fluke could it be? 10 games? I mean, if the Sox were to win 82 games, maybe you could say that this team could have won 82 games. No matter what, even if this team probably would have played up to their capabilities based on the fact that they lost 90 games, they still would have fell short. They still probably would have been a third place at the very most. So I'm not really sure what defines a fluke. Because I didn't necessarily expect this team. I know this team was going to compete, but I didn't expect this team to come in and all of a sudden win this division or even do any damage in the playoffs. That was me. So if you lose 90 games and you have a fluky season, well, the team obviously had a talent to win more than 72. How many more, I think, is the big question. And I think that might be where Kenny Williams might be a little bit confused on.
Yeah, I really think that, bottom line, if I were the GM of this franchise, I'd probably go about it a different way, but it is obvious that Williams is going to build. I mean, it was made obvious, and it started with the Mark Burley and Jermaine Dye extensions, which happened pretty close to the trade deadline,
yes.
And it continued on when they signed A.J. Pierzynski to a two-year extension.
The extension will make
A.J. most likely a White Sox for the next three seasons because he's under contract already next year, and then the extension kicks in starting in the 2009 season, so it'll be for 2009-2010. So that's another veteran member. So they've now have Paul Konerko under contract for the next couple of years. You have Dye under contract for a couple of years. You have Burley under contract for a long time. And then obviously you still have Tomei for this season, and then possibly there is an option for the following season as well. So some of these guys are under contract, and obviously Josh Fields is a young player that's going to be here for a long time. So you have that going for the Sox, I guess. And hypothetically, you could make a case that, yes, this team was a lot better than a 90-win team. If you brought back the exact same roster, I think the Sox would win at least five to eight more games as is, no changes made. And then if you can add some more talent on top of that, sure, you could contend. But this is an old ball club, and I think with a couple bad moves, as Gene Honda Civic over at Southside Sox has put it best, or otherwise known as Cheat, you're basically a bad signing or two away from being the Baltimore Orioles of the late 90s, early 2000s.
This is probably the first time. I mean, you know, I'm 25, well, you're 24, so we're still pretty young Sox fans, but I know as far as in my time, this is probably the first time that I've ever looked at this team and was extremely doubtful and afraid in a way as to how things could turn here. And I think that's a huge, huge problem because you're right. Cheat's right. They are one, two trades away from this team being a disaster and being in a big hole for a very long time. Now, as far as AJ Pierzynski signing goes, I think that does kind of cap things off as far as the theory that the Sox are going to go out there and they are going to try to win and win at all costs next year. I think that's pretty clear. If you bring back Pierzynski and, of course, a Dye signing and Azeguin was signed to an extension. I'm not sure if we ever brought that up. So with all these things kind of in place, it kind of does signal that the Sox are going to go out there and kind of go balls out, or at least Kenny Williams is going to go balls out on the market this year and try to put together a team. As far as more on Pierzynski, ideally, I wouldn't. He's kind of rubbed me the wrong way over the past year or so. So ideally, I probably wouldn't want to have him as catcher. But seeing that the situation with the Sox, the system is so depleted right now with catchers, I'm not really sure there's anyone on the market that they could go out there and get. He is probably the best option for the next 2-3 years.
I think the thing is the system has no talent in the catching position down in the minor leagues, and AJ is going to be a solid guy for the next 2 or 3 years. Therefore, you do sign this guy. You do extend him. I think the money was fair. It wasn't a discount by any means. It wasn't like the Burley contract. But you have to make sure you have a catcher for the next couple of seasons. AJ can always be traded. No, you're not going to get a great prospect if you trade him, but he can be dealt, and it's a good move to have. And I don't mind having a guy like Dye back. I don't mind having a guy like AJ Pierzynski back. I definitely don't mind having Mark Burley in the rotation, but the White Sox are going to have to make good moves this offseason, and it's going to start at what they do with their young players. Is Danny Richard going to be their starting second baseman? Is Jerry Owens going to be their starting center fielder? Is Juan Uribe, not really a young player, but is Juan Uribe going to be back at shortstop? Because those are really the only three open spots in this lineup, assuming Joe Creedy is going to step into third base, and Josh Fields, who is now not going to be playing in the instructional league, will stick at left field. So you have pretty much those three spots are the spots where you can make some moves to change the lineup. And this is a lineup that didn't succeed. It had a major lack of a top of the order. You had the middle of the lineup, which I think will be a lot better this season. But bottom line is, this is not the greatest offense, and you're talking about right now already. This is a day after the season has officially ended for the White Sox, and you only have three potential moves that can be made: center field, second base, and shortstop. And I really think Richard has got the job at second. You've seen a lot of PR lately that Juan Uribe may have the job at shortstop, and Jerry Owens, even though he had a really great finish of the season, he could even have the job in center field. So where are the changes going to happen, and what changes do you think Kenny's going to make?
God, that... I have to say I'm clueless, and I think it goes back to what I'm saying. I have no idea right now what Kenny Williams could possibly be thinking. It's amazing right now because I think Danny Richard is their starting second baseman. I think we said this in the last show, though, that I think they do need to find somebody to back him up. That's fine, but your second base situation is still kind of up in the air. Juan Uribe, while I think he fills a spot on certain teams, he doesn't fill a spot on this White Sox team because he's a good defensive player who offensively you don't know what he's going to do, and he's not really that athletic type who could add a lot to your offense on the bases. And then you have Jerry Owens, who I think Jerry Owens has at least earned himself a shot to be looked at, but considering this White Sox team needs a lot more than Jerry Owens, I think unfortunately he might have to kind of have to step aside. But I seriously, I'm freaking clueless.
Personally,
I know
I
it's
think
not good,
the
but
key will be, I think the key will be, and it's going to be really interesting to see what happens at the organization national meetings and the plan that kind of gets put about and what goes down at the winter meetings, because I think Kenny is going to be active at the winter meetings. I think you're going to see him make a move. But there have been some indications that he's not afraid to deal, make a big deal. He's not afraid. He's going to look at every single player. That may mean in Alex Rodriguez. I still don't see how financially they can do it. But could there be a little writing on the wall that maybe a guy like Paul Konerko gets moved? That could be the type of adjustment. Yes, Paul Konerko is one of the premier offensive players on the White Sox. Yes, he's signed to a very affordable deal. But at the same time, if you're going to make a change and you're going to try to make one of those deals where you trade one guy and end up bringing three good guys in, Paul Konerko is probably that guy. Jermaine Dye has a no-trade clause. Mark Burley has his no-trade clause. Jim Thomae has a no-trade clause, so he's not going anywhere. And no one else really in that offense can be the type of guy that you deal with to get two or three pieces back and get some financial savings as well to go with it. So I really think if the Sox make a move, and it would happen early, you're talking about a guy like Paul Konerko. So that's my guy to watch. What happens with the Konerko situation? Because he is well-liked by Ozzie Guillen and Ken Williams. But at the same time, first baseman, yes, it's a premium to get offense. But first baseman are kind of a dime a dozen type of position, especially ones that can hit. And the Sox can do better things with the type of guys you get in with Paul Konerko. You could fill some holes, and you could become a better all-around team by moving him.
So trading a Konerko to fill a shortstop position, obviously taking into account that the shortstop you're getting is of equal values, seeing that Konerko's a first baseman, would you be for that for either a shortstop or a center fielder?
Oh, I have no doubt. I would be all for a Konerko move. I've always said that we could trade Jim Thomae, but that's probably not going to happen. Konerko was likely the guy that, you know, would go. Would he like to go? No. Would the Sox like to move him? No. But if they get a fair offer, I think Ken Williams has to consider it, because you could fill some serious holes. You could get some young talent in here. You make your team younger. You make your team faster. And you still have Thomae and Dye in the middle of that lineup. And you can find another first baseman somewhere. You can find a DH-type bat. You can do a lot of different things. You know the Angels would love to get a guy like Konerko. You know the Dodgers, who are looking for a lot of power, would love to get a guy like him. You have a guy like Rafael Furcal in prospects. Could that work? Yes. The Dodgers could have interest in Jose Contreras or John Garland. And Furcal obviously fits the needs of the White Sox, being a top-of-the-order type bat, playing a shortstop position. He plays good defense. He has a big contract, yes, but you could make that type of move. So Ken Williams is going to be looking at those type of things. Ken Williams may look at Barry Bonds. It's going to be very interesting, but right now it's just really too hard to say what he's going to do.
Yeah, from a position player standpoint, I think Konerko is unfortunately probably the guy who you think about trading, but not necessarily sure if his character is going to allow that. Just him being, I'm sure, a fan favorite with quite a few Sox fans. But you were talking about John Garland and Jose Contreras. I think John Garland is probably the prime trade bait for this team. He was kind of scuffling there in August for a little bit and finished off the season pretty strong. Granted, it was against the Kansas City Royals, but he did finish off the season strong. So he is probably the primary trade bait, because really, if you had to put money on it, Konerko probably won't get traded. If there's one guy in the position players who would get traded, you probably could think of Konerko, but Garland is probably the one guy who you would have to say is a definite, right?
Yeah, and what the Sox are going to have to ask themselves is, can they contend without John Garland in that rotation? And the obvious answer is no. No, they cannot. Legitimately consider those themselves contenders with Garland out of that rotation and Gavin Floyd and John Danks in that rotation. However, if you had seriously upgraded your offense, maybe you could. If you got some serious pitching prospects back or young talent back, then yes, maybe you could. Maybe you got an Irvin Santana and a shortstop prospect like Brandon Wood for Paul Konerko. Maybe at that point, yeah, you can do it. But bottom line is, John Garland is going to be interesting to watch, because if the White Sox are smart, they would move him, unless they can sign him, and they would move Jose Contreras as well. I do not think you either keep Garland and move Contreras, or you move them both. That's what you have to do. I mean, really, I actually have no idea what the Sox should do. I think it's just a mystery, because they're bringing back the same team that lost 90 games, and it makes no sense to me how you're going to contend with the same team that lost 90 games. So somewhere in there, you're going to have to make a big shift here and a big shift there. And to me, that big shift is going to be with Garland and Contreras moving, and I don't think there's a problem with the rotation as is right now, although I would like to get Contreras' contract out of here. And I understand that if Garland's going to walk in a year, then it's better to move him now. And then offensively speaking, the only way you could possibly make any changes is by moving a Paul Konerko, or by just making some huge signings and giving Torrey Hunter 50 15
Yeah.
million a year,
You know what? That's
or
this.
Andrew Jones 15 million a year, but I don't think that's smart.
On the chat, this Bug Me Not, I'm assuming that's how he would like his name pronounced. He was talking about the team should be rebuilding. And the problem is like you said, if Konerko is your only guy you could really trade at this point because you signed Przinski, you re-signed Dye. Creedy's obviously coming back, so you can't really trade him. Tomey has a no-trade clause. If you can't trade it, the Sox are putting themselves in a situation where they have to go at it next offseason, so they have to spend the money. So unfortunately, if they're going to bring all these guys back and they think that they're going to make a run for it next year, they're going to have to overpay for somebody. They're going to have to overpay for some position player in this offseason. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
And the way they could go about it.
Rebuilding is not an option right now. It's not. I think maybe a couple months ago it was. Maybe July it was. But it's no longer an option. With Dye being re-signed, with Przinski being re-signed, I don't think rebuilding is an option.
Oh, you're right. The Sox basically put the writing on the wall that they're not going to rebuild. Therefore, if you move Konerko and you get two or three good young players, plus you spend that money that Konerko was, earmarked to make, and a little bit more on a guy like Andrew Jones or Torii Hunter, no, they're not as good offensive players as Konerko, but they do play a premium position, and therefore I think they're more valuable than Konerko because they fill center field, and it's easy to find a first baseman, then I think you can be all right. And yes, Konerko equals seats. But at the same time, wins equal seats. Konerko was there before they were drawing. Pasenik were there before they were drawing. But when they won the World Series, that is when the fans came.
Now, as far as the rotation goes, Burley, Vasquez are obviously the top, but there's been some pleasant surprise for some younger guys. John Dank started off the season rather well, kind of slowed down. He was shut down. Now, I believe the last time we did this show, he was I think he was still in the rotation. I believe they haven't decided to shut him down yet. Did you agree at all with them shutting him down, or should they kind of let him fight through it?
I didn't have a problem shutting him down because John Danks had really, really, really deteriorated late in the season. He couldn't command his stuff. His strikeout numbers actually improved. But I think it was overall a good season for Danks because I don't think anyone was expecting him to do what he did to make the team out of spring training. And
he
I
hung
think
he's
in learned
there.
A lot. And he's going to be better prepared for next season. And I still think 2 years from now is when you really can count on him being anything more than a fifth starter, which is why I say if you move Garland and Contreras, then you better be getting some type of real good prospect or going after a veteran stopgap for that rotation so you're only relying on one of Gavin Floyd, Gio Gonzalez, John Danks next season and slowly get in a second piece because otherwise you're not going to do anything. And did anyone say that we're going to get a good prospect for Jose Contreras? No one did. No one did. But you know what? You could get a bad contract for him and you can make a move. And yes, you could trade Jose Contreras. Mark my words, you could trade Jose Contreras.
Lance Broadway also got a star, which kind of surprised me, but it was as a result of Mark Burley being given his last start off, because I think it was because he got his 10th win. I think he went over 200 innings, so he kind of reached his goals. But Lance Broadway did start, and he had actually a pretty productive start. And I think I would bet a lot of people were probably not really having many high hopes for him, at least going into this last start, or in general for his career, right? He's kind of dropped on the Sox list, I believe.
I never thought too highly of Lance Broadway, and my opinion of Lance Broadway immediately changed after watching that start. Lance Broadway looked good. He looked like a John Garland Jr. type pitcher. He had absolute filthy movement, and this guy, if he can develop and harness and improve his command, which I think he's fully capable of, especially because most of his movement has came in the last season after he started throwing that cutter and two-seamer down in Charlotte. This guy can be good. This guy can be a number three starter, no doubt. Number three starter, no doubt about it. This guy is going to be good, and the White Sox need to hold on to him because his trade value isn't adequate of what he's going to be worth 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road because he's going to be in the rotation. That's right.
Off one start. Well, the small portion I did see him of that game, he looked like he might have some potential. It's obviously a tough situation for the Sox because of Gavin Floyd. I think he's worked his way into at least being considered. But like we talked about, if you have Burley guaranteed a spot, and Vasquez guaranteed a spot, then it looks like they'll probably keep either Garland or Contreras. You kind of would like to see, you know, a Broadway Floyd Danks battle for one spot rather than two out of three of them getting two or space rotation spots, and that seems like we might that might be what the Sox might be running themselves into.
And that's probably where Contreras will stay in the rotation. Garland will get traded for prospects, hopefully positional prospects, because I think the White Sox have enough guys that are going to be able to mix and mash and find their way into developing into good starters. I think at least two of Garland can, or at least two of Broadway, Egbert, and Gio will develop into good starters. And then you have Faustino De Los Santos coming up later on. So I don't have much issues in terms of the rotation in the next few years, because I think those guys will eventually be able to slide in behind a Javier Vasquez and Mark Burley, and Contreras eventually slide out. I would prefer to trade Contreras, but I can understand them not being able to do so, and not doing so because they're intending to contend and they want him in that rotation and they think he'll be good next season, because Ken Williams again has said that it was him tipping his pitches, which I find complete bullshit. Bullshit, because tipping pitches has nothing to do with your fastball going from 95 mile an hour to 87 mile an hour, and I have absolutely no idea how tipping your pitches makes your fucking forkball look like a hanging effing forkball changeup, just a meatball, a meatball.
Well, unless it was always believed that his 89 mile an hour fastball looked like a 95 mile an hour fastball, at that point, then tipping his pitches could kind of make sense, right?
I can't even see the logic of what you just said. I'm assuming you're being sarcastic.
Well, no, if an 89-mile-an-hour fastball looks in the eyes of a hitter like a 95-miles-an-hour fastball, and then he tips his pitch, then 89 will actually look like 89.
The radar gun said 95 when he was good, 88 when he was bad. That has nothing to do with tipping pitches. The radar gun doesn't involve the hitter turning around going, wow, that pitch looked 95, therefore it is 95. No. Now, you could have sneaky fast fastballs. I think Lance Broadway has a sneaky fast fastball. The way that he was blowing it past guys. I know, I'm absolutely horrible. I'm out of it. And Neil Kotz obviously had a sneaky fastball, as Harris says. But, fuck, I lost my whole train of thought now. I'm really out of it today.
Let's get more positive when it comes to the White Sox, and let's get into their bullpen, because that was probably one of the lone bright spots for the season. Kind of. I guess.
Yeah. I mean, the bullpen was the lone bright spot because you had Bobby Jenks, the supreme closer in the American League. J.J. Putz, yes, he was great. But you know what? Bobby Jenks has done it for three seasons now. Three seasons. There ain't a better closer in the American League. Now, there may be some on the same level, but there ain't a better closer in the American League than Bobby Jenks. And he deserves a lot of credit. Now, everyone else in that bullpen deserves to get a slap on the face because they are the number one reason the White Sox lost 90 games. I put the blame on a lot of other things, but they're the number one reason.
I'm not sure if I could say that there's nobody better, just for the simple fact that this past year, Jenks has been in situations which really haven't meant anything. So, yeah, he's coming in the ninth inning with one, two, three runs leads, but when the team is 20 games out, those games really don't mean that much. So I'm not necessarily sure I would put him say nobody's better than him. I do think he's one of the top ones, and I think he's slowly working his way up to being one of the best closers in the game, or at least one of the best relievers in the game, purely by the fact of the way he pitched this year. He didn't have the velocity, but he had the movement. He had that cutter. He seemed like to have a little bit of a sink or two. So I think that alone makes him one of the better relievers, but I'm not sure if I could say that nobody's better than him.
Note, I didn't say he's the best. I said nobody better.
I know.
No, Mariano Rivera is not better. Is he better in his career? Yes. Is he better today? No. Could he be at the same level? Maybe. Could K-Rod be better than Jenks? No. Same level? Yes. K-Rod is not undeniably better. Good old bug me not. I completely disagree with you. You look at his stats, and Bobby Jenks' stats are better. Bobby Jenks is just as good as a pitcher. And Jonathan Papelbon, yes, he's a great closer too. But I'm bunching them all up in a similar category. They're all amongst the best in the American
League.
But
when it comes to closers, don't you kind of have to compare guys based on what team they're on to that particular year?
Hell, isn't it harder when you know you're going to get nothing? No. it's harder to get as many saves as Bobby did on a losing team than it is on a winning team, because the sheer fact of the matter is you're going to get more good save situations when your team wins. Yes, you may blow more of them, but you're going to get more opportunities to save the games. And with that horrendous bullpen, Bobby Jenks had everything thrown on him, and he still was able to deliver on the season.
I don't know if – I'm sure you'll get more opportunities, but the better teams are also going to have those blowouts. And they also probably have a bullpen that could probably shut down an opposition with other relievers outside of their closer. So that's all I'm saying in regards to that. I think it's hard to kind of lump them, because when you're talking about K-Rod, he is with the Angels, a playoff team. Papelbon with the Red Sox, a playoff team. So they've been pitching in a little bit tougher situations. I'm not disagreeing with you. Jenks is definitely one of the better ones, but – let's get into Wasserman, because he was one of the kind of bright spots for the bullpen, because he did play kind of good and at least good enough to earn himself a spot into next year's roster, as well as Boone Logan.
Yeah, Boone Logan, Aaron Wasserman are both guaranteed. They're locks for this bullpen next year. Locks. And whether you want to disagree with that or agree with it, I don't care. They're both going to be there. Ozzie's pretty much stated so. Kent Williams has shown their support for that. And both of these guys are going to develop into some of the better relievers for their position in baseball. Logan will be one of the better lefties out there. And Wasserman, yes, he's a righty. Yes, he has a little bit of deception. But you know what? The guy gets good movement and he gets out. There's no way to deny the fact that he got guys out in the A-ball, double A-ball, triple A-ball, and he kicks some ass at the major league level. And I'm not going to deny those statistics. I don't care if he throws 88 mile an hour. I don't care if he looks funky when he throws. He gets guys out. And not enough people appreciate guys that get guys out. Yeah, you could throw 100 mile an hour. Matt Anderson threw 100 mile an hour. What did that get him? He was a closer in Detroit for what, a year, 2 years? And he busted big time. Give me a guy that gets guys out on a consistent basis, and you know what? I'll put him in my bullpen, and I'll take it. Look, for example, at the San Diego Padres bullpen. Yes, they have Petco to help them. But you know what? That bullpen is one of the best in baseball. It has guys like Doug Brocale. Obviously, there's Heath, I think, is his name. But bottom line, this is a guy that can pitch. Yeah, Heath Bell. That's correct. But this is a guy, Wasserman, that can pitch and he can get outs. And they're going to have him under contract for a long, long time. Yeah, he's going to be in that bullpen. In fact, it may scare a lot of people, but this bullpen is not going to change very much. You're going to have Wasserman in there. You're going to have Logan in there. You're going to have Jenks. And you're probably going to have Thornton and McDougal back in there unless the White Sox get a good value in the trade. And I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, as far as these relievers go, Wasserman going to get a guaranteed spot. And I'm sure some people could have some doubts about him, but you only could go by what you do know right now. And if you were to put him in next year, I think he does deserve some type of spot. But the White Sox do have to improve this rotation. And like I've said for many times over this show, it's so hard to build it because it's so much of a crapshoot. So you can't just go into the free agent market and sign 2-3 guys and expect everything will be solved. But I do think they're going to have to get some veterans. It's either time to potentially, well, not take a break. We're not going to take a break because we're going live. But I do think we should probably start talking about the Bears.
Yeah, that's right. Willie Harris called it. And this is going to be where I get my fire. Because you know what? The White Sox season, there's nothing to be really fired up about. And it's really hard to see what they're going to do until we start getting some articles coming out, until the organizational meetings happen and you have some leaks out there, and really until the World Series comes to an end, because that's when the news is going to start coming out. That's when we see whether they're going to pick up your Uribe's option. And once that happens, you'll get a lot better idea of what's going to happen.
Let's pretend, though, that we're talking about the Bears prior to the season, because prior to the season, there was some high hopes for them. Some said that they were easily the best team in the NFC, and they were perhaps one of the team to beat. And now they have just collapsed in a way, and they've looked ugly. And Grossman has been replaced. Really not his fault completely. Greasy.
Repeat that. I want everyone to hear it.
In this particular season, it wasn't really all his fault. Now, that said, he's had plenty of instances in the past 2 years to kind of prove himself, and he failed in a lot of those occasions. So this particular year, it wasn't his fault, but it doesn't mean a change wasn't warranted. At the same time, like I said, it wasn't his fault, because when you look at this past game, Greasy wasn't particularly good, but neither were the receivers once again, neither was the line once again, and this defense, of course, has about 3 healthy starters.
I think it's important to point out, number one, I was one of the many that guaranteed, well, a Super Bowl repeat for the Bears. I thought they would go back there, and I thought they'd win it against the Patriots. Now, that may have been a ballsy prediction. Nah, it really wasn't. The Bears were on paper one of the best teams in football. You can't predict the injuries that happened to that defense, but I think it's important to look at the fact that this offense got a lot of hype in the offseason, and it's failed miserably to live up to that hype, and I put a lot of that blame on the players. I don't put any of that blame, at least not much of that blame, on Rex Grossman or Brian Griese. And we know that I hate to live and piss out of Brian Griese. I think he's an absolute piss poor quarterback. I think he's a pure backup quarterback. The guy is garbage. I got a stronger arm than Brian Griese. And I'll get into my Griese evaluation later on. I'll get into my Grossman evaluation later on because I think Rex Grossman needs to be the starting quarterback of the Chicago Bears. But the thing starts with the offensive line. This offensive line has utterly failed the Bears, and I think I remember on one of our previous shows, probably the one that we did 34 days ago, that I said if there was anything that was going to go wrong with the Bears, it would be the running game, and it would be tied to the aging offensive line. And if there's anywhere that Jerry Angelo has failed as GM of the Bears, he has failed in adding some draft picks over the last year to two-year span that could slide in and make this line younger. Because you have vets like Fred Miller, you have vets like John Tate, you have vets like Reuben Brown, you have vets like Olin Krutz, and those guys have gotten older, they've gotten slower, and they failed. They have flat failed.
Is this maybe an older offensive line? Kind of just wearing down? Because they don't look particularly fast.
It's an older
fast.
Line that's just not handling it. And you got to hope it can get better, that they should be able to improve on the assignments, because the first three games, the quarterback, Rex Grossman, got killed. Last week, Griese got a little bit more time, but the job of the line was still not done. But I also want to point out that I've seen a lot of stuff coming in from the media this about Grossman and all the stuff that I heard on Grossman. And this is a sore subject with me, but I want to tell every one of these people that they're freaking complete, utter morons. Morons. Now, I'm not saying Rex Grossman's a star quarterback, but I am saying that he is the best quarterback on the Chicago Bears. He was last year. He was the year before when he was hurt, and he is this year. There's a reason he's a starting quarterback, because he is so much better than Brian Griese. Now, we can maybe make a case for Kyle Orton being better, because we don't know what Orton can do, but we know what Brian Griese can do.
First of all, as far as on-field production, Rex Grossman has had plenty of chances, and he's failed. Now, Brian Griese has had plenty of chances in the past, but as far as the Bears are concerned, that was one start. So if the Bears are going to give Rex Grossman the 2 years that they gave him, maybe they should give Griese at least a couple starts. Now, as far as the whole Grossman is their key quarterback, the only reason I will agree with you in that is because the way as depleted as this Bears defense is, and as bad as they are right now, they need somebody at the quarterback who could put up a lot of points. And as bad as Grossman could be, he has the potential to put up 20, 30 points on any given night. And that's maybe what the Bears need right now. So I think it might be a high-risk, high-reward situation with Grossman that they might have to take.
Well, first off, Lovie Smith came to peer pressure. It came down to the peer pressure of the Chicago media and the national media for why Rex Grossman was benched. Because there is absolutely no way that Rex Grossman should have been blamed for any of those two losses out of the first 3 weeks. Nor should he have been blamed for the mediocre play in the Kansas City Chiefs game, a game where the offensive line absolutely left Grossman out to get killed. So I want to put that first and foremost out there. You bench your quarterback if you think that he's doing the inappropriate job. And there is absolutely no way that you could have possibly gotten any sort of evaluation out of Grossman when the offensive line is doing horrible. Grossman was getting pressured. He was getting sacked. And this is a quarterback that doesn't have a history of holding on to the football
too long. So do you replace the offensive
or getting
line?
Back too much. You can't replace the offensive line.
Okay.
But after 3 weeks, you do not replace the quarterback. Do the New Orleans Saints, after 4 weeks of terrible play, do they go out and replace Drew Brees?
The Bears did not replace The Bears did not replace Grossman because of his play 3 weeks. They replaced him because there's been such speculation and there's been heat on them to replace him for the past year. And I'm not going to completely say that the Bears were right in doing that, because I do think a lot of people like to put blame on Grossman because it makes them feel better. Because if you could take a team of 40, 50 guys and you could put the blame on one guy and you could say one guy is holding us back, it makes you feel better at night when you sleep. Because then you realize, you know what, if we just replace that one guy, we'll be great. But that's not the case here. They need to replace many guys, but it's always easier to find the one scapegoat. At the same time, Grossman's poor play goes back to last year. So it wasn't three games that made Lovie Smith replace him. I don't think it was the three games.
Well, I want to point out that Rex Grossman made all the throws in the playoffs. Yes, he had a poor Super Bowl, but that poor Super Bowl actually started off for three quarters being good. It was until the fourth quarter when he was trying to force the issue, trying to lead a comeback where things went wrong. So he led key drives against Seattle to get in the field goal range, a key pass to Rashid Davis. He had a good game against the New Orleans Saints. He had a horrible game, obviously, against the Green Bay Packers. We all know about that. But this is a quarterback that, yes, he had his ups and downs, but this is a quarterback that in his first season has as of a successful first season as any other quarterback in the National Football League ever. Now, I'm not saying he was the most successful, by all means. No, I'm not saying that one. But he had a very successful season for first-year seasons based on that standpoint. And in 2006, the Chicago Bears offense, in terms of scoring, was light years better than it was in 2005. And that was a difference that one Rex Grossman made. It was also a difference that having Ron Turner in there for the scheme helped out. And obviously the offense was better. You had Bernard Berrien emerge. You had a lot of other things go wrong. And one, Ron Turner hasn't gotten enough of the blame. He hasn't gotten enough of the criticism yet this year. And I put a lot of this thing, as much as I put it on the offensive line, I put it on Ron Turner because his play calling has been poor. The way they've handled Cedric Benson has been miserable. Benson has gotten a lot of criticism. He's actually became the new scapegoat. Now that Rex Grossman's gone, they turned their attention to Cedric Benson, and Cedric Benson is getting unfairly blamed. He's getting blamed for the fumbles. Yes, fumbles are inexcusable, but Cedric Benson is a guy that when he was drafted out of the University of Texas, fourth overall, he was drafted as a workhorse type of running back. And has he ever, ever gotten a game where he gets 30 carries and is actually a workhorse? No, he hasn't, because Ron Turner doesn't stick with the run. Ron Turner? How many times did the Bears run the ball this past week?
There's no doubt about that. I think Brian Griese threw over 50 times last game. Didn't he throw like 50 times? No, I'm agreeing with you. When your quarterback's throwing that many times, yeah, that is a problem. And the thing is as soon as Benson makes a little mistake, they pull him from the game. So he should get more carries. But at the same time, with the few amount of carries that he has, he should be doing a little bit more. Granted, the offensive line has some serious issues.
Here's the thing. Have you ever seen them even give him a fucking chance to get in a rhythm? No, you haven't. You know why? Because the Bears are afraid. We already know. This. I can say this about Rex Grossman or Kyle Orton, or I can say this about Cedric Benson or someone else. Because what we know about Adrian Peterson, the running back, and what we know about Brian Griese is the fact that neither of them are NFL starting quarterbacks right now. Well, Griese being the quarterback and Peterson being the running back. I've seen enough of Adrian Peterson, and if this guy was a starter, he would have started sometime in the last four or five seasons when he was in Chicago. Yes, he's a valuable third stringer and a valuable special teams player, but he is not a running back. He's not a starting running back, and he's not even a third down back. The Bears need to realize that they don't have that. So they need to see if Cedric Benson can be that guy, because otherwise you don't have a starting running back on this roster. Not one, because Adrian Peterson ain't a starter, and Garrett Wolfe will never be a starter. We know those things. Garrett Wolfe wasn't drafted to be a starter. He was drafted to be a third-down type of back, and it was a stupid draft pick. I'm sorry, you Northern Illinois fans, but it was a mistake. If they wanted to use a guy in a third-down type of role, they should have just started grooming Devin Hester for that role and start using him as a running back type of guy in third down, split him up in a Reggie Bush type role occasionally in the slot position, and do those type of things with Hester. They shouldn't have wasted a third-round pick on Wolf. But this gets me back to Cedric Benson. What the Bears need to do is over these next 3 to 4 weeks, and they should have done it for the first 3 to 4 weeks, is just say, Benson, you're going to be our guy. We're not going to play Peterson. We're not really going to go to Wolf. We'll occasionally bring them in on certain situations, but you're going to get 30 carries. And we're going to give you those carries, and I want to see what you can do. Because if you do that, you do two things. You tell Benson that you have confidence in him, but it's going to be over a short span, and you're going to give him the opportunity to build himself into a rhythm, because those type of running backs take time. They need to get into the rhythm, and they need consistent carries so they can get rolling. Look at what Miami did with Ronnie Brown. Ronnie Den Brown, who was taken second overall in the same draft as Cedric Benson, had been kind of considered a bust early on in his career. But what did the Dolphins do this season? Cam Cameron basically said, you know what? We're going to see whether you're the real deal or not. And they started giving him carries. They gave it to him full time, and he responded the last 2 weeks by having breakout career games. Hell, look at Benson. The one time they gave him the ball at least semi-consistently was the Kansas City Chiefs game, and that game he had 100 yards and he had a solid game. So I want to know why Ron Turner hasn't won with the run, and I don't want to hear a bullshit excuse that the Bears have been losing, because the fact of the matter is, aside from the Cowboys game, the Bears have not been losing. They've had leads into the fourth quarter of all these games, and one of the reasons they've blown these leads is they don't run the ball, they have horrible time in possession, and that means the defense is going to be worn down and beat out in that fourth quarter. They're not going to be able to get to the quarterback, and that's something they rely on to help the secondary stop the pass, and they will get burned in that fourth quarter.
Good job. Are you done?
Oh, I'm not done. I've just begun, because I still have my greasy evaluation of the week.
Oh, God. See, you can't do that. You can't go and talk about Grossman being, you know, not being given a fair shot and then rim Greasy for one game. Especially
since
we...
Are you ready for me to rim him for a game?
What's that?
Are you ready for me to rim him for a game? Or rip him,
why,
I should say?
Why do you... Okay, here's the thing. Do you think Greasy was caused last week's loss as much as Grossman caused the previous week's loss?
I want to point out that I think there's a very few games that you could put a loss on Rex Grossman. Very few. Super Bowl I put on the defense and the team as a whole because they got completely outplayed. In fact, I put more of the Super Bowl on the Indiana Colts being a better team than I do on the Bears, even though I think the Bears really didn't show up. I think they got smacked in the face and they got beat at their own game, a physical type of football game, by the Indianapolis Colts. Aside from that, no, there's not many games I could put on Rex Grossman. I could put the Arizona Cardinal game on Rex Grossman, even though they won that game. That was definitely a game that could go on Rex Grossman. And I could definitely put the Green Bay Packer fiasco on Rex Grossman, but that was a meaningless football game. So I could put those games. I could put the Miami Dolphin loss on Grossman. But there aren't many games I could put on Grossman. The Cowboys game and the Chargers game definitely don't go on Rex Grossman.
Is it be? Are you talking about just losses?
I'm talking about this season. If you want me to look specifically at this season, the first three games of the season, I definitely do not think that the Bears lost because of Rex Grossman against the Chargers. I think the Bears lost that game because they couldn't run the ball. Their offensive line played poor. It was just and the Chargers played good, despite. With their record, the Chargers did play good in that game. And then you have the Dallas Cowboys game where I, again, can't really put it on Rex Grossman because Rex Grossman had a good first half, and then he really fell apart when the Bears really lost it and he couldn't get any momentum. Benson had a key fumble in the third quarter of that game. Berry had tons of drops, and things really went downhill. And then in the fourth quarter, they were down big time. Grossman started throwing stupid passes. I would be the first one to put that on him, and they failed. But that game was lost well before Grossman made any mistakes. But the game against Detroit, yes, I will put that game a lot more on Brian Griese's shoulders because the team went to Brian Griese because he wouldn't make mistakes. And they lost this game because Brian Griese did make mistakes.
I'd agree with that. I would
he
agree with
two
that.
Two interceptions in the red zone, and all his passes throughout the game were behind him. But my problem with Brian Griese wasn't with the results of the game. It's with how he did it. It's the fact that Brian Griese can't throw an out pass to save his life. And when he does, you're going to see it get taken to the house. Or any time he throws more to the sidelines, you're going to see it more likely to get taken to the house and bring back for a pick six. And that's what happens when he made that bad throw, errant throw around midfield that the Lions brought back for a touchdown. That's what happened. And you saw it on balls where, let's say you had an out pass to Bernard Berrien at 7-8 yards, and Griese threw it. All of a sudden, you had a corner on Bernard Berrien that hit him right as the ball came in. Or Musha Muhammad, or whoever the receiver may be. And the reason that corner got there and is able to make that earlier him back was because Brian Griese's ball gets there a lot later, and it gives the corners time to adjust and close and make a play that they wouldn't be able to make if Grossman was a quarterback. When I think about Rex Grossman, I think about a guy that can make every single pass in the NFL. He can make a deep pass as good as any quarterback in the NFL almost.
Can he make every decision in the NFL?
Oh, I will get to that. I will get to that. I actually see a guy that can read the defense and make good decisions. However, when flustered, when things don't go his way, that is when he can get into bad tendencies and get into bad rhythm. And that is something that he'll have to get over. And I don't know if he'll ever be able to get over it. I'm not saying that he's necessarily the quarterback for next year, but I'm saying he is the type of guy that can make plays, that can make all the passes in the world, that can make good reads, especially when he has confidence. And he's the type of guy that's going to be a pretty good quarterback in this league. He'll never be the greatest quarterback in the league, but he can make all the throws. And I can't say that about Brian Griese.
Okay, you talked
I don't
about,
think
you,
Brian
Griese
is that smart.
You talked about Grossman needing confidence. I'm not sure if you saw his last press conference, but honestly, it looked like he was going to cry. Now, if you're in a press conference and it looks like you're going to break down in tears, now, a lot of that is because the Chicago media and Chicago fans are just jerks, but if you're going to cry, you're on your you have a long, long road on your way to recovering to being a confident quarterback. And as far as like the whole decision-making thing, when you have a bad line like the Bears do, you have to have the ability to step up. I'm not a football genius, but if you're moving back and you have the ball and guys are about to hit you, it's not a bad idea to move. It's not a bad idea to take a step up, to maybe run once in a while. It's not a bad idea to look at every single option. There's some plays where he hikes the ball, he looks in one spot, and he doesn't take his eyes off it. Now, as a quarterback, I believe you're supposed to look at the whole field, and you're supposed to move around when you need to. And that's the thing, is how come he has not come close to learning a lot of these things over the course of 3 years?
I got to be honest with you. Really, one of Rex's strengths, and it's contrary to popular belief, is the fact that he does a very good job going through his progressions as a receiver. And there is
Jace?
What?
I'm not sure if anyone actually heard what you just said. At least I didn't. Did anyone hear what he just said?
What I was saying is, contrary to popular belief, that Rex Grossman is actually good at going through his progressions and going through his reads. He does a good job, and he goes through his reads different than a lot of quarterbacks. He goes through his reads different than Brian Greasy. Greasy goes from short to long. Grossman goes from long to short. He looks for the big plays first and then comes down. And that is why he's a better quarterback for this offense, because he's the type of guy that can take pressure off of the offensive line. Yes, he needs a good offensive line to succeed, and I do think the Bears' offensive line is capable of turning things around. But Rex Grossman has the ability to get the safeties out of the box again and start throwing the ball downfield. But the problem is Ron Turner's going to have to start calling some deep balls and calling those type of plays, because in the first three games, I think Grossman threw one pass really down the field. And that's a mistake, because you're going away from Grossman's strength. And that's something that can really pull the safeties back, can get this help get their running game going, and help turn things over.
Okay, I want to ask you a question as far as what you would have done to fix this team. But one aspect, we talked about it, obviously, the offensive line sucking. These receivers, mainly Berrien, have been brutal. And, of course, you have other guys like maybe Desmond Clark and Greg Olsen who just haven't been involved in the offense. But as far as the receivers go, how much blame do they get?
Oh, the receivers get a large amount of blame. They get more blame than Brian Greasy or Rex Grossman. I think in terms of the offensive scale, Rex Grossman is Brian Greasy and Cedric Benson are actually down on the bottom end of things, because it's much bigger than that. Olin Krutz had a great quote today. It's Chicago Sun-Times, I think it was, and he basically said, "Now you guys get to see that the problem wasn't Grossman. We have had a lot more issues than that over the last 2 years, and it has nothing to do with Grossman's play at quarterback. It has everything to do with everything else." And it seems like if you read through the lines, the problem actually stems from Ron Turner. And Lovie Smith, at the press conference, I think it was yesterday, was asked whether the Bears would consider bringing a consultant in, and Lovie immediately said no, and he stuck by his coach. But I think you have some people questioning Ron Turner, because you have a problem when every single person in a bar can tell you whether it's going to be a run or a pass. You know when a receiver goes in motion that they're going to run the ball every single time, especially when it's motion. And they need to change that up. Because if you can predict things, if you, the casual fan, and I'm talking to myself in that picture, can predict things, then so can any good offensive defensive coordinator.
I was able to predict it last year, and honestly, I'm an idiot. So if I'm able to predict it, I'm sure the opposing teams could easily do it. But yeah, this is a Bears team that offensively, it seems like they line up, and if they're going to pass, they line up as is, they run the routes as is, and that's it. And there's not much as far as creativity going on.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I have absolutely no problem with a vanilla offense, but I do have a problem when every time you put a guy in motion, it's going to be a run play. I think you should do a lot of different
things. But you need to have the right players for that too. You know, it's not like the Bears have an all-star receiving core or an all-star quarterback or an all-star, running back. I mean, they have good players, but even with that, I think you have to have some creativity to the offense, and you have to be able to help them out and make things a little easier and not rely on just the players alone getting the job done.
I agree with they only have a decent offense or the capabilities of a decent offense, but what can make that offense great is the field position they get turned over to them by both Devin Hester and that Bears defense that forces turnovers, and that alone can really turn that offense into a better one, especially when you have Greg Olsen. And one of the biggest mistakes of last week, and there were a lot of them made by Ron Turner, and I know Harris has just pointed out too, is where is Greg Olsen in the middle of the field? Where was he? Because Brian Greasy, the only place he was really having any success was down the middle of the field. He had Clark on a couple passes in the middle. And
that's the type of quarterback he is, though, isn't he? He's a short quarterback in the middle of the field, and you have a Greg Olsen who is just non-existent.
And that's where Olsen should be. I want to know where Olsen was in the red zone, because this is where, even if Olsen doesn't make the play, you make the defense have to play for, and worry about him, and that could leave another option out there open.
Okay.
So I want to know where he was, and I want to see, and I was glad to see Mark Bradley at least getting some playing time, because Bradley, along with Barron, are the Bears' two most explosive receivers. Musha Muhammad.
And if one of them can't catch the ball, maybe the other can.
Yeah, and if Musha Muhammad can't make catches, then you're going to have to start getting Mark Bradley out there more and throw Musha Muhammad, who I still think is a very solid receiver, and he can do a lot of good things. He's possibly one of the better blocking receivers in the NFL. But I think you could definitely slide Musha Muhammad into the slot position and move Rashid Davies at down. Because Rashid Davies, as much as I like the guy, as much as I think he has a cool story coming from the Arena Football League, Rashid Davies is not a good third-string wide receiver. He's mediocre at best, and I think that's even pushing.
If you give Musa Muhammad
would be
some
a very good slot receiver.
If you give Musa Muhammad some short passes and kind of let him muscle his way through the defense, which he has a capability of doing because he is a pretty physical guy, and then like you said, do some blocking, which he'll be able to do in the slot. I think that could be a much better situation for the Bears. Now I want to ask you this final question. Like I said before, I think we're going to end this at 10 o'clock. You were Lovie Smith, you see the Rex Grossman situation, you see the running back situation, what would you have done? Is it just a matter of having a team meeting and just telling everyone that they fucking blow and that they need to get their heads out of their asses, or do you make changes?
I definitely, as much, and you guys have heard me here, criticize the fact that Greasy quarterback. I was criticizing his play because I really did not see a problem in at least trying Brian Greasy. I don't think any time off would have hurt Rex Grossman. I think the problem is when Lovey gave Greasy the job, he also said, we're going to give you every opportunity to succeed. And while that's great to say, I would have rather just said, hey, we're going to give you the job for now. If you play good, great. If not, Rex Grossman, he was our best quarterback in preseason. He was our best quarterback last year. He was our best quarterback in training camp, and he's probably going to be our guy if you don't do a good job, and we're going to go back to him. Because I think a week off could be one of the best things that could ever happen to Grossman, because whether anyone wants to question his mental fortitude, I mean, if anyone wants to question his mental fortitude, I really think they're absolutely idiots, because I don't see how you can. This is a guy that's answered every single question. He's never put the blame on anyone else. He's always stood there and taken the heat, and he's taken more heat than any NFL player I've ever seen. And most of it, yeah, some of it's deserved. Most of it isn't. Most of it isn't. You want to say he's a bad quarterback, fine. But no quarterback, no guy that is as much spoken up and taking the blame and taking the responsibility as much as he has, no one deserves what he's gotten. No one.
I don't know if I could say he's tough. Just by looking at his demeanor, purely on his demeanor. Obviously, I don't know Rex Grossman, and unless you're really in that locker room with the other players when they're, you know, in practice and everything else, nobody could really say. But just by his demeanor, by his actions at press conferences, he doesn't look like a particularly tough guy, and he looks like a very defeated guy who lacks a lot of confidence. A lot.
I just want to say, if he doesn't have confidence, there is absolutely no way the Chicago Bears would have stuck with him as long as they did. There's no way guys like Olin Krutz, who's a true tough guy, and Olin Krutz isn't the type of guy that would just say, hey, you know, he's all right. There's no way they would have. And those Bears players, maybe one or two guys said otherwise, but those Bears players really, really, really like and respect Rex Grossman. And it ain't because he's a coward. It's because he's tough. It's because he stood up. It's because he's taking responsibility. And I don't buy any of that bullshit Ron Rivera said. Ron Rivera was jealous of the fact that he's not going to get a coattail off the Chicago Bears defensive success anymore. What's Ron Rivera done down in San Diego? This defense is much better without Ron Rivera as the head as the defensive coordinator. And you could talk about all the injuries all you want, but this defense is so much better under Bob Babcock. It gets so much more pressure. It's so much more exciting. It ain't even funny. So Ron Rivera and Ron Rivera's dirty-ass comments about Rex Grossman were sheer jealousy of the fact that he's no longer in the Bears organization, and they let him go. And you know what? I wish Ron Rivera nothing but the best, but he has a little bit of jealous spite because he knows that he never got quite all the credit he thought he deserved over the Bears defense because
he wanted
it was Lovie's system.
He wanted a head coaching job because of it, and he couldn't get one. He thought that was pretty clear, like, hey, you know what, we're going to the Super Bowl, we're going to Super Bowl for our defense, I'm the defensive coordinator, I'm going to land myself a job, and he never did. So I could buy into that potentially, but as far as the Bears players backing him up, I think that's just by way of Lovie Smith, because Lovie Smith seems like a guy who doesn't really go out there, he's not too outlandish, he's a very, answers the questions the way, you know, to keep things safe. And I think the Bears players kind of go off that, and they answer the questions safely. They're not going to openly criticize anyone on their team because he's our quarterback, he's the guy we back. And that's what a lot of their responses have been. He's our quarterback, he's the guy we back, he's the guy we support. So I don't know if I would say that the Bears players are fully confident in Rex Grossman. I think maybe Lovie Smith is, and I think that is kind of moving on to the players, but I don't know if the players individually believe that.
Trust me, the National Football League, if the team wasn't confident, Lovie Smith, one coach, one man, wouldn't be able to get past that. Now, every one of these players respects Lovie Smith, but you can bet your ass that the vast majority of them respected and were behind Rex Grossman. Look at Mushi Muhammad. Look how much he always stood up and stood behind Rex Grossman. Look at Bernard Berrien. He stood up behind him for a long, long time. These were all guys that stood up. Yeah, you have the Tommy Harris comments about Donovan McNabb, but you know what? Who blames him? Donovan McNabb's good. And the number one guy is Olin Kruse. Olin Kruse ain't a pussy. He ain't a company man. He's a long-time Bear, but he's going to say what he thinks is going to be best for the team, and he's going to say what he thinks and what he feels. For Christ's sake, he socked Fred Miller in the jaw and busted his jaw. Why? Because they had a dispute. And you know what he said? He said Rex Grossman's our guy. He said it has nothing to do with Grossman, this, you know, all this. And you got to take that, and you got to respect that. Fuck what Ron Rivera
said.
Ron Rivera's a defensive coordinator. What the hell does he have to do with the offense either way? Ron Rivera, he gets my D-bag of the war.
You're not going off of Ron Rivera. And if Olin Kruse is going to punch someone, maybe he doesn't punch people because they're soft. Maybe he punches people because they're just being a dick. So if it's Rex Grossman, if he doesn't have confidence, doesn't mean he's a jerk. He might be the nicest guy in the world. And maybe that's why the Bears have confidence in him. And like I said, because Lovie Smith is showing support for him, I think the players are just being safe. Because not many players are openly going to go out there and question the player on their team, at least on this Bears team, by way of Lovie Smith.
They would question it. There ain't a team out there that wouldn't question if they really thought Brian Griese or Kyle Orton were the right guys. They would question it, no doubt about it.
What do you mean question it? By way, what would they say to the media? If I were to say, do you think Rex Grossman is your guy? What are you going to say?
It'd be real simple. They would say it. They would say it.
I disagree. Not in today's. Maybe some guys would, but in this Bears team, it seems like none of them would.
Bullshit. After a year, if they didn't think he was the right guy, someone would say it. Something would come up. They wouldn't have stuck with him that entire season if that wasn't the case.
They were winning.
They saw that Brian Griese wasn't
because they were
that
winning.
Good.
When you go 13-3 and you go to the Super Bowl, you're going to be happy with whatever. You're going to ignore a lot of the flaws that your team may have. Right?
No.
That's in any
no.
sport. That's in any
no,
sport.
That is not true.
What do you mean it's not true? If a team goes to a championship and they have a flaw, the next year players are not going to remember that. They're going to realize that we won. We won last year. We're going to do it again, no matter the situation. And the Bears defense felt like we were good enough to overcome anything.
No, that's not what happened. And we're just going to have to agree to disagree on this. We're going to have to agree to disagree. And I want to focus now on the upcoming week.
I want to agree to agree.
They play the Green Bay Packers.
Disagree with me.
They're playing the Green Bay Packers, and it's going to be a key game. We're going to have to see if that defense can come back because it's a must-win game. And my feelings are this. If Brian Griese has a good game, you play him out. You play him out. If Brian Griese has a bad game, you turn things back over to Rex Grossman, and you let Rex Grossman play until Week 8. At Week 8, if Rex Grossman's done his job, the Bears may be close to .500. They'll be in playoff contention, and he may be the guy of the future. If they don't do that and they don't play well and they lose under Grossman, then at that point you turn the show over to Kyle Orton, you let him play 8 weeks, you get your evaluation out of Orton, and you see what's going to happen. He's
Well,
good.
Listen, let's seriously call it a show. I have a bedtime. It is 10 o'clock at night here in Chicago, and that's very late for me, extremely late for me. I have to take my nap. I have to go to sleep. I have to do my exercise because I'm a clumsy ass who falls off bicycles while mountain biking. So
it sounds like a story. And yes, I witnessed this guy breaking his elbow in Canada. It was quite the experience.
Yes. For those of you... yeah, don't fall off bicycles.
Now you can say you actually hurt something worthwhile on this show.
It could hurt. It could really, really hurt if you fall off a bicycle while going downhill.